The Colin McEnroe Show would like to apologize for last week's special Ear Witness Citizen Sentinel report, Pinkberry, There's People in It. Based on subsequent reporting, we're confident in saying that Pinkberry is a delicious frozen dessert that does not in any way contain people. For our original report, we relied too heavily on a source who identified himself as Dr. Vaughn Boyage, an organic chemist formerly in the employ of Pinkberry. The Colin McEnroe Show has learned that his real name is Herbert Johnson and that he runs a go-kart track in Vernon, Connecticut. In addition, we'd like to emphasize that there is no known connection between Pinkberry and the Church of Scientology, nor does Pinkberry have a 7,000-acre rainforest preserve in Costa Rica in which attractive young people are forced to engage in Hunger Games-style battles to avoid being added to Pinkberry. There is also not, as our report claimed, a 7.5-mile-wide asteroid hurtling toward Earth and certain to wipe out all of human life here in May of 2014. We apologize for the confusion. And now, a little boy dressed as a tiger cub. Correction, a bitter old man in mismatched clothes, Colin McEnroe.
I like the harp on our new news theme there. I like that. So anyway, to recap, no people inside Pinkberry. Just go ahead and eat the Pinkberry. Don't worry about anything. Enjoy Pinkberry. And we do regret our error. We are going to talk a little bit today about a more prominent error than that one in the world of journalism. Let me quickly set the stage for you because it is something that we're – a little change that we're making in the flow and style of some of our shows. We have been your typical public radio show for 4 years of our existence, which tends to mean that we work far ahead on projects. We have producers working on things days and days ahead. And lately we have been thinking, you know, a lot of times we have something scheduled for a day and a lot of other things have attracted our interest in a much more burning and compelling way. So for the first show of the week every week, and we were actually off yesterday for Veterans Day, but for the first show of the week every week, we are trying to do these shows where we really kind of decide more or less at the last minute, at least for us, by our standards, what we're going to talk about. So today, joining us in just a second, Eric Deggans, you've heard him before, NPR's new TV critic, will join us. And one of the things we do sometimes with people like Eric or Mike Pesca is let them tell us what topics they want to talk about. He wants to talk about the poor representation of people of color in the coverage and conversation about the Affordable Care Act. Also, he's going to talk about one of the last new fall TV shows to be introduced this season. Towards the end of the show, from Amsterdam or from somewhere in the Netherlands, from the Max Planck Institute in the Netherlands, Nick Enfield will join us. You may or may not have seen this report over the weekend. There's been a linguistic study of the phrase, huh? And it turns out it seems to be just about a universal human intonation meaning the same thing, which is just – it just doesn't happen anywhere else. I mean, if you were to sort of catalog all the things that various languages say is the sound that a dog makes, you would get a lot of really disparate sounds. So the idea that as a human race, we all say, huh? We don't know what somebody's saying is kind of an amazing notion. We are going to begin, however, by talking about CBS and 60 Minutes about an apology and a retraction that they have conducted over actually sort of a series of two announcements starting on a morning show last week and then continuing on Sunday night on the actual 60 Minutes. This all involves a report they did on October 27th about the incident in Benghazi in 2012. They relied very heavily on one particular set of interviews with a contractor over there who said he was sort of in the thick of the fighting around the embassy. He was there. He'd seen things. He'd even hit somebody with the butt of his rifle that he'd seen the ambassador, the body of the ambassador. He'd seen a lot of different things. The story has not held up, and this is why, in fact, CBS has had to go through some of the convolutions that they're going through right now. Jay Rosen is on the journalism faculty at NYU, and he's the creator of Press Think, a longtime and much respected and much used by people like me blog about journalism and its modern ordeals, especially here in the digital age. Jay Rosen, I know you've been following the CBS situation very closely. Just maybe in a thumbnail, I mean, give us your sense overall on how well or how poorly CBS in 60 Minutes has handled this pretty complicated situation. Or maybe it's not a complicated situation.
Huh?
Yeah, okay. Third segment, actually.
It's a mystery. how CBS has handled this situation, because as soon as the Washington Post reported that there were documents giving a completely different story than the one they broadcast, their story was in a lot of trouble. And they didn't seem to recognize that, although anybody with journalism training could recognize it, and I'm sure a lot of viewers could as well. And they seemed to be in a state of denial, which was particularly poignant and fascinating to me as an observer, because they had gone through something like this in 2004 with the Air National Guard story that ended Dan Rather's CBS career. And so that's why I wrote about it, because it was so reminiscent of some of the bad errors they made in that case. So it took them a week to recognize reality, and when they did, it was embarrassing for them. And we still don't know how they could have believed this guy.
Yeah, and just for people who haven't followed all that closely, this guy is sort of a private contractor over there. As I said, he sort of depicted himself as having been in the thick of things. His name is Dylan Davies. He's a security contractor. Depicted himself as having been in the thick of things, having seen everything that was going on around the embassy. And as it turns, I mean, it seems anyway, I don't know to what degree or other this is completely, absolutely, irrevocably nailed down, but he certainly told his employers and then the FBI on two different occasions. He basically said no, that didn't happen. He'd stayed at his beachside villa. He might have tried to get to the embassy, but ran into roadblocks and went back to the villa and kind of waited things out there, which is, of course, very different from being there at the embassy or visiting a hospital to view the corpse of Ambassador Christopher Stevens. And to whatever extent he wasn't there, this story does, Jay Rosen, kind of fall apart. And what you're saying is that it would have been easy to figure out, for certain reasons, earlier in the reporting of this, and certainly post-reporting, it was relatively easy to figure out that there were gigantic problems well before CBS ever agreed to do a retraction.
That's right. And even before that, CBS acknowledges that it knew he had given a different story to his employer than he was telling them. They knew that before they went on air with this gentleman. And he also had written a book in which he describes some of his heroic exploits. So right there you have something worth thinking about. He gives a rather unexciting account of his inability to get to the scene and do much of anything to his employer and to the FBI. And then he gives a much more dramatic and exciting account that has him at the center of the action in his book and to CBS. So doesn't that occur to anyone at CBS that comparing these two accounts, you might want to question whether the account in his book, which they did read, was accurate? Now, they didn't know about the FBI report. He had told them that he gave the same story to the FBI, but they didn't know about it and they weren't able to obtain it. That's another mystery here, is why didn't they look into that? But when you read the book, there's an excerpt floating around that I read this morning. It doesn't ring true in any sense.
I read the same excerpt that you did. This is an excerpt in which subsequent to all of these events, the FBI and several other officials, there's a group of, I think, five people from the U.S. government who go to see Dylan Davies and to talk to him about what he was or wasn't able to do to help people in all these kind of Errol Flynn-like exploits that he's having there. And he's, you know, kind of saying, oh, well, I could have done so much more, and it took me too long to get over the wall, and I wish I'd done more. And everybody gets very mawkish, and people get choked up, and they hug him and tell him he did the best he could. He did great. And there's quite a lot of coffee being served in this scene, and tears. And in general, I mean, as a journalist, in general.
Would it raise any flags?
Yeah, because, I mean, the FBI, when they're coming to actually check out your story, they don't hug you.
Yeah.
You know, they just never do that. If they're coming to check out your story, if they are trying to compile an official record of something that happened, something with a lot of the world's eyes and ears on it, too. This isn't some minor traffic beef.
Right.
This is Benghazi. So they show up and they really want to make sure they understand your story and that you're telling the truth. They never hug you.
They just don't identify with you emotionally either.
No, they don't get choked up. They don't cry. They don't tell you you're a wonderful person either, because they don't know whether you're a wonderful person.
Right.
They're still trying to figure that out.
Right. And there are plenty of people at CBS who know that.
Yeah.
So that's why I feel CBS owes us and its viewers, but really itself, I mean the other journalists as well at CBS, an explanation for how something like this could happen, because it's so inexplicable.
Well, you're also saying, Jay Rosen, we kind of have a Lance Armstrong problem here, maybe not quite to the same degree, but you've got one problem, which is you went on the air with a story that even now, according to you, is basically wrong. I mean, according to you, Lara Logan, CBS, 60 Minutes, all the people who are basically recanting this story, you went on the air with something that was wrong. So that's offense number one.
Right.
Offense number two, and this is the one that you seem most interested in, is that Lance Armstrong problem. The more time you spend protesting your own innocence or lack of culpability, the more time you spend staving off your detractors and suggesting that they've got it wrong, the more you're kind of piling up another set of offenses in a different category.
Right. You are compounding the error, and you are also, with each day, you're carving deeper into the trust that you need to do your job, because people can deal with mistakes. But when you compound those mistakes by denying and distracting and responding to things that people aren't even saying, and creating smoke screens like, well, this is all partisan warfare, which has nothing to do with it, then you compound the error and you deepen the mistrust.
The another set of questions that's being raised, and I just got a tweet from Kevin about this very same thing. You can tweet us at WNPR Colin, is the question of consequences. And you know, you mentioned 2004. In 2004, I think, you know, a credible case could be made for the statement that this kind of wrecked Dan Rather's career. And certainly there were people fired, producers fired over this. I mean, this was a moment of severe convulsion for CBS and for 60 Minutes with everlasting consequences for the participants in it. Now, the way that this is being treated so far, this comparable event is being treated so far, it has been a little bit more like, oops, you know, we made a mistake. We didn't quite understand that we made a mistake, but we certainly care passionately about the truth. It's the most important thing to us. So now we're saying that we were wrong, and let's move forward.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Respond to that.
Well, let me tell you something very interesting about that. So far, what CBS is saying is there will be no investigation, there will be no consequences, there will be no one fired. There will be nothing. We apologize, and that's it, and we're moving on. So that's what they're saying. The executive producer of 60 Minutes, which is the person with final responsibility for that show, is also the chairman and ultimate boss of CBS News. Now, for the boss of CBS News to take any action against anyone involved in the story on CBS 60 Minutes, he would have to put himself in a situation where he's disciplining others, but not himself.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
He's not going to do that,
yeah.
Right? He's not going to fire himself from his job as the executive producer of 60 Minutes. And if he doesn't fire himself, then how can he take action against anyone else?
That would seem to be a structural problem.
That's a structural problem. Mm-hmm. And the only person who can solve that problem is that person's boss, which is not even a CBS News executive. So now we're talking about the CBS hierarchy. And so in that sense, it's even more screwed up than the Dan Rather situation, which was, you know, a huge crisis. So that hasn't, I think, been focused on enough, and that's why the spokesman. I talked to several reporters about this. This is kind of interesting. They ask, is there going to be any investigation? Is there going to be any consequences? And the CBS spokesman simply recite to them in a sort of a monotone all the things that CBS has done to show its contrition and apologize. And they don't answer the question. They just repeat what's already been in the record, and they just sort of leave it hanging there.
So one of your issues here, too, is, and I don't know if we've emphasized this enough, I mean, I sort of call it a Lance Armstrong problem, but the other part of it is you, as a press critic, as somebody who studies journalism and critiques journalism, you want a news organization, when it becomes clear that something that they have reported is very possibly wrong, that there may be severe problems with the story, you want them to actually put themselves in a completely different gear. You want that news organization to say, all right, we are shifting gears now, and all of our efforts will be bent towards figuring out what happened here and whether or not we made a mistake and getting the details of that mistake out in public as quickly as possible. And your feeling is CBS didn't do that. It was a little bit more like, do we have to explain this whole thing?
Yes. I mean, I think it's actually fairly easy to know what to do. You don't have to say right away before you check it out, before you know we were wrong. Mm-hmm. You don't back off immediately because you could make another error. You don't want to do that, right? So, but you don't want to be unresponsive either because that deepens mistrust. So what you should do, and I don't think this is very hard, is say, whenever there are questions about our reporting, we investigate because we want to get it right. We always want to get it right. So we investigate. That doesn't say you were wrong. It doesn't discipline anybody. It doesn't put a mark on anyone's record. You just say, we're investigating. And then you come forward with what you find. And I don't think that this is too much to ask. It's actually a very commonsensical sort of approach. It limits liability, and it prevents these kinds of disasters. But for some reason, that's like too much for them.
We're talking to Jay Rosen right now. He's the creator of Press Think, a great blog about journalism, and it's Modern Ordeals. He's also in the journalism faculty at NYU. Let's add to this conversation Eric Deggans. Eric Deggans has been on our show in the past. He's the NPR's media critic and TV critic and correspondent. Eric, you've been watching this whole thing unfold. I want to ask you and Jay Rosen in particular about one aspect of this, and that is, you know, in fact, if we could just flash back to 2004 when Dan Rather was having problems about a similar incident. This is, of course, the coverage of George W. Bush's service in the National Guard. I actually have this really vivid memory of Jeff Greenfield, I think he was on CNN at the time, explaining how this story had been pushed forward by bloggers. And bloggers were a very strange word in 2004 to most people. And so at one point, Jeff Greenfield said, So who knew that these bloggers were the kinds of people who had expertise in typewriters and in the actual mechanics of typewriters? Because a lot of this involved, you know, IBM Selectrics, and could this memo have been typed at this time given the state of typewriter technology? And I was watching the TV and I was thinking, no, Jeff, bloggers don't have expertise in typewriters. Bloggers have time. they have time to go and figure these things out. And so they have time to go to typewriter stores. They can do all kinds of things, because bloggers, particularly in 2004, that's kind of who bloggers were. They were people with a certain amount of unencumbered time that they were prepared to spend for no pay whatsoever, you know, second-guessing CBS or doing whatever else they wanted to do. But so, Eric Deggans, now what we have, you know, you look at all of the entities that contributed to the reporting and second-guessing of and fact-checking of CBS on this, and you're talking about the Washington Post, but you're also talking about the Huffington Post. You're talking about Media Matters, which isn't really exactly a journalism entity. You're talking about the Daily Beast, you know, that in a way the landscape really has changed. And even though there are big companies that own a lot of things, there are a lot of people who can kind of get into this game and ask questions about what you're doing.
Yeah, that's true. I would say that one of the big differences between now and MemoGate in 2004 is that in 2004 you had this cadre of people who were online, bloggers, online columnists, whatever you want to call them, who were convinced that Dan Rather was liberally biased and that he was tilting reports on CBS News to favor a liberal agenda. And when they found a story where they felt like they could pound him with that, They did, and they went after him aggressively and continuously until the flaws in the story were revealed, and CBS felt a lot of pressure to kind of deal with this out in the open. I do think that the way we've seen CBS handle their response to this story now reflects that knowledge, that experience. You know, what CBS got in exchange for being very open and honest about what happened in the Memogate scandal was that their president of CBS News got pushed out, Andrew Hayward. Dan Rather got marginalized at the network, the anchor, and he got pushed out. The producer who was over the story got fired. 60 Minutes 2 got canceled. And there was this huge public report prepared by independent people that, you know, made the whole news division look bad. So given all of that experience, I'm not surprised that 60 Minutes now is not necessarily willing to cite chapter and verse in how they screwed up this story, because the fallout from the last one was so bad. I will also say that CBS is not alone in taking this tack when it makes mistakes. And I've written several stories complaining that outlets like CNN and Fox News and others, when they make mistakes, they don't say exactly why they made the mistake. They admit a mistake sometimes, and then they give you the correct information, but they don't necessarily say why they screwed up. And for example, we don't necessarily know for sure why some outlets reported that there was an arrest imminent in the Boston bombing when there wasn't, and that the suspects were these dark-skinned males. We don't know exactly who revealed that information and why some news outlets got it wrong and others didn't, because a lot of news outlets were not transparent about who they talked to and why they screwed it up and what they were going to change going forward to make sure that they didn't make that mistake again. So part of the difference here is that Laura Logan doesn't inspire the kind of heated, you know, opposition from liberal people that Dan Rather inspired from conservative people. And I think that's a big reason why CBS is not feeling as much pressure to reveal exactly why they screwed up the story.
Although I wonder if, and I'm going to ask both of you about this, but I'll start with you, Jay Rosen. One of the things that I have wondered is if post-2004, if what we're seeing now is, and not merely as fallout from 2004, but for myriad reasons, if what we're seeing here is a CBS that really did ideologically diversify itself even more, so that we know that one element of this story is that this this security contractor, Mr. Davies, was publishing this memoir almost simultaneously with the 60 Minutes report, and he was publishing it with his CBS corporation imprint called Threshold Editions, where I believe one of the senior editors, if not the senior editor or editor-in-chief, is Mary Madeline. And this Threshold Editions apparently does kind of specialize to a certain degree in sort of conservative kinds of books written by, you know, I mean, every member of the Cheney family probably eventually will get to write a book published by Threshold Editions. And then you've got Laura Logan. I don't know anything about her or what her politics are, and I think it's easy to get those things wrong, but one of the things that has been turned up over the last few days is that she's been running around making speeches specifically about Benghazi, calling for retribution for the terrorist killings of Christopher Stevens and three other officials. Here's one coverage, a bit of coverage from the Chicago Sun-Times. After a speech, Logan hopes that America will exact revenge and let the world know that the United States will not be attacked on its own soil, that its ambassadors will not be murdered, and that the United States will not stand by and do nothing about it. So you've got a correspondent who's out there kind of making this a pretty passionate issue for herself. So, Jay Rosen, I'll ask you first. Is part of this that CBS was kind of trying to refashion its own image a little bit so that people wouldn't, as a default conclusion, assume that everybody who works for them was conservative?
It's certainly possible. Mm-hmm. And I think there's no question that CBS is more likely to react to a firestorm on the right than it is to complaints from the left and from organizations like Media Matters. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any question about that. The CBS book division that you mentioned, Threshold Books, doesn't just publish some conservative authors. Its purpose is to publish conservative nonfiction. That is what it says on its website. Mary Madeline, the Republican talking head and political operative, is an editor-at-large. She's not the editor-in-chief. She's an editor-at-large, which probably means she helps put together books with prominent conservatives, put together deals for books. But anyway, that imprint is essentially part of the conservative media complex, Breitbart or Red State. It just publishes books instead of publishing blogs. And I think that's relevant. The statements that Lara Logan made are kind of unusual for a CBS correspondent. I think most CBS news executives would tell you that the people who cover politics and national security for them don't have declared views on the subjects they cover. That's what they would say. There really isn't any explanation for why she's covering for 60 Minutes a story on which she has put forward some very clear and potent views, such as we have to take military action and kind of like show retribution for this act against our consulate. I mean, that is what she was saying in a very emotional way. So that's kind of strange, too. And so that's another reason why I think it's weird that there's not going to be any investigation, although Eric is right that other networks have shown that they can do this, they can get away with this. And it's remarkable that none of these major networks have an ombudsman, as if they couldn't afford it. You know, CNN only makes $400, $600 million a year, so we know why they can't afford an ombudsman.
Well, you can afford the ombudsman. You can't afford all the consequences, the ones that Eric described.
Yeah.
And, you know, those get actually pretty expensive for their shareholders. And as somebody who has a lot of money in a CBS 401k, I should recuse myself from this entire conversation. I certainly hope CBS pulls through this just fine. All right, so Jay Rosen, so great to talk to you. We're going to bleed this conversation over a little bit with Eric in the next segment. We'll talk about whatever Eric Diggins wants to talk about. But one of those things is going to be a new development in the world of press criticism. The world is abuzz this morning with news that Brian Stelter, one of the leaders at this for the New York Times, will now become one of the leaders for this for CNN. All right, we're back with our Tuesday show. Joining us still is Eric Diggins, NPR's media critic and correspondent. Eric's going to run through a few topics that he's interested in this week. And Eric, just one thing that kind of does bleed over from our previous segment's conversation is the news about Brian Stelter. He has been kind of a rock star at the New York Times. People who saw the documentary recently released about the New York Times, Brian Stelter could have been the star of it if David Carr were not so colorful and interesting. But he's a guy that everybody knows. He's moving over to take over CNN's reliable sources. And you know, this story that we just talked about, this CBS story, happens at a time when there's just more and more programming and coverage and digital work that does analyze how the press performs. That's actually become kind of a star profession as opposed to kind of a sideline gazing profession. What's your take on that?
Oh, well, first, let me say I'm the TV critic for NPR. NPR has a fine media correspondent,
That's right.
Dave Falkenflik, who covers sort of the industry of media, and I'm more focused on sort of entertainment and the content of media. So I just wanted to make that clear.
We don't want Falkenflik getting nervous about
TV critic
about you. Yeah.
is my title. But, I will also reveal in the interest of full disclosure that I guest hosted Reliable Sources on August 25th, and I also guest hosted it on Sunday. And many people some of the folks who guest hosted the show were also, I guess, considered contenders for the job, although I don't ever think I was a contender to get the job full-time. The thought originally was that somebody would be hired to do what the original founding host, Howie Kurtz, who's now at Fox News, did, which was he was a media critic and reporter at The Washington Post for 18 years and also hosted Reliable Sources. When he left to go to Fox, I think originally everybody thought that they would do the same thing. They would hire somebody with a big media job, and they would do Reliable Sources on the side. Now, I can tell you, somebody who's done the show twice, that is a gargantuan job, mm-hmm. and I'm amazed that Howie Kurtz was able to balance two really demanding jobs at the same time for so long. It makes more sense to do what Brian did, where he decided to leave the New York Times. He's going to be a media correspondent for CNN full-time and then also do Reliable Sources and put that show together. Now, so as I said, CNN has had Reliable Sources for 18 years. So this is, it's not a new development that CNN has a show about the media. There are a lot of online outlets that are devoted to talking about media and how media works. But I think TV in particular has been very reluctant to have shows that really delve into how media works. Even shows that are supposed to be media analysis shows often wind up, you know, not being as incisive as you would like. Mm-hmm. So I think it's kind of interesting that we now have two shows doing this on cable TV, and they're airing at the same time. Howie Kurtz's Media Buzz show is on Fox, and Brian will be doing Reliable Sources on CNN at 11 a.m. as well. And their biggest challenge, I think, is going to be covering stories that they are involved in. You know, what kind of coverage will we get about the mistakes in the Boston bombing coverage when it includes CNN?
Mm-hmm.
You know, did I don't think Howie Kurtz talked a whole lot about Fox's role in pumping up this Benghazi story after 60 Minutes reported on it, but they ran a lot of segments piggybacking on some of the stuff that 60 Minutes revealed in its now retracted story. So I think they're going to face similar challenges in that they're part of the industry that they're covering, and how transparent will they be about the mistakes that their channel makes?
You know, when it's done well, that kind of thing can be riveting, too. Margaret Sullivan's the current public editor of the New York Times. I think she's the toughest on the New York Times public editor they've ever had since they created that. And she's just turning into kind of a must-read person because she really goes after the newspaper and goes after what they do. But it's as you say, it's unclear whether Kurtz, whether Stelter, or any of those people who do things like that on television function as an ombudsman or ombudsperson, whatever we want to call it, you know, somebody with a real free hand to.
Well, they don't function as ombuds people, because an ombudsman's job, I mean, Margaret Sullivan's job is to make the New York Times accountable to its readers every time she does something.
Mm-hmm.
That is not the job of Brian Stelter and Howard Kurtz. Their job is to report on the interesting media stories of the day. The question is, what happens when the most interesting media story of the day is a story that involves your channel,
mm-hmm.
Particularly if your channel is at the heart of that story? If CBS had a version of Reliable Sources, how would they cover the 60 Minutes thing? You know, Laura Logan, as far as I know, has only spoken up about this retraction in two areas. She was on, or three areas. She was on CBS This Morning, she was on the CBS Evening News, and she was on 60 Minutes, all outlets controlled by CBS. So that's sort of the question that I think we all face when we try to cover media for a media outlet. What do we do when the story involves a place where we work? And in TV, it's more complicated because, you know, Margaret Sullivan can be a one-woman band. You know, she goes out and interviews people. She writes the story. It gets published. Television is a collaborative medium. You have to work with producers. You have to work with production people. You often have to rely on help from people who work on other shows or people who work in other parts of the building. And, of course, you're answering to executives who also oversee the areas that, you know, you're talking about. So it's a little more complex and more difficult when you're trying to criticize or highlight mistakes made by the place where you work.
Let's do a little other media criticism in the time that we've got here with Eric Deggans. One of the things that you are interested in is the way in which the Affordable Care Act, in support or lack thereof for the Affordable Care Act, doesn't seem to prominently feature as much as it might African Americans and Latinos, who in polling seem to support the Affordable Care Act. I'll sort of just hand the baton to you. One of the things that you're interested in is that question. Is the mainstream media exploring this obvious source of support for Obamacare?
Well, the short backstory is that when I hosted the show on Sunday, I had a guest on who covers issues related to media aimed at people of color and covers how people of color are covered in mainstream media. And one of the things he pointed out was that Latinos and African Americans especially seem to support the Affordable Care Act, but their views are not necessarily included in all these stories about all the problems with, you know, the website and implementing it and people's uncertainty about the Affordable Care Act itself. And I think, you know, some of that is that the media is enjoying this conflict between the administration trying to make the Affordable Care Act work and the many questions about it and the criticism that's coming from the administration's opponents. And part of it is that there's a reticence to sort of look like a shill for the administration by featuring people who actually support, you know, this cornerstone of Obama's, you know, administration. So, but I think the result of that is that sometimes the voices of people in certain groups who are supportive of this, you know, get overlooked. And, you know, proportionally, there are a lot more, you know, people are more affected by being underinsured and uninsured in communities of color proportionally, you know, much more. It's a huge issue for Latinos and black people. And so I think those groups in particular were really looking forward to seeing the government take some kind of action to make it easier for them to get insurance. And I don't know that that voice has been, you know, as prominent in media as you might hope it would be.
You know, one of the other sort of connected stories here that's not being covered that much is the failure of Medicaid expansion in those states which essentially opted out of that part of Obamacare because the Supreme Court said that they could do that. So that you have 60 million people on Medicaid right now under Obamacare. 13 million more could have been added to Medicaid. According to a study by Kaiser, this will mean up to 6 out of 10 people who are eligible for Medicaid will remain excluded simply because of the opting out process. And this is essentially a political battle. This is Republican governors looking to punish Obamacare or to in some way, you know, eviscerate it somehow. And to me, that's another part of this.
Yeah, it's scary. I mean, I'm in Florida. I'm in Tampa, in St. Petersburg, Florida, the Tampa Bay area. And here in Florida, a previous governor, Charlie Crist, accepted $3 billion in stimulus money from the Obama White House. And there was a big event where this Republican governor, you know, hugged Barack Obama, and that got turned into an ad that was run against him time and time again when he tried to run against Marco Rubio for one of the Senate seats from here. And Charlie Crist, this former Republican governor, failed in that attempt, in part because he was linked to taking money from the administration. And Republicans, you know, hated him for it. And so now here in Florida, we're in this situation where, you know, our new Republican governor, Rick Scott, is encouraged to turn away money that might be used to help people in the state because politically it makes him look bad, and he's got a tough reelection fight coming up next year against Charlie Crist, who's running as a Democrat now. And so, all the politics of all of this winds up tying the government in knots. And people who need help, people who need to be insured, people who need health insurance help from the government, you know, one of the things that's happened here in this state is that we have these people called translators that are supposed to help people navigate the rules of the new Health Care Act. And the state government has been hostile to helping them reach people in this state because the governor here is so opposed to this Affordable Health Care Act. And so, again, your people at the end of the line, the people who need the services, are the ones who are not being helped. If there was an alternative service that was being offered to people, that would make more sense. But what's happening is people are just being denied help, and that's never made a lot of sense to me.
All right, Eric Deggans, you are NPR's TV critic. We've just got a couple of minutes left here, but I know one of the things that you've focused on is a new series called Almost Human, one of the later rollouts this fall. It's on Fox, I believe, and it has the imprint, anyway, of J.J. Abrams, a much beloved name in fantasy and sci-fi on it. What can you tell us about Almost Human?
Well, Almost Human, it probably will be, I think, the last network TV series to debut this fall. And it features Carl Urban. You may recognize him as he plays the Dr. McCoy on the Star Trek reboot films, which J.J. Abrams also directs and is involved with. He plays this tough cop 35 years in the future who's forced to work with a synthetic human as his partner. And the twist of the show is that the synthetic human has all the software that makes him react emotionally, and in some ways he's more human than this shut-down emotionally human cop that he has to work with. And the two, you know, it's a fish out of water buddy comedy cop or buddy drama cop thing. But they've spent a lot of money on the pilot. It looks really nice. I think Fox has high hopes for it. And another thing that's interesting to me about it, Michael Ealy, who plays the android cop, is African American, and it reflects Fox's way of placing non-white and white leads as co-leads in shows. They've done that in three of their new shows now, Sleepy Hollow, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and now this show. It seems to be working in terms of diversifying television in a way that viewers also seem to like. And so this is going to be a landmark show in a lot of ways, the latest fall entry, and also a reflection of Fox's diversity on camera.
Although, I haven't seen the show yet, just watching the promos and watching that exact phenomenon that you just described, I've just seen 12 Years a Slave, and now I'm seeing that everywhere, and I'm thinking, oh, so the African-American guy is property in this. And, you know, he's
right.
And I wonder if they're going to deal with that. I mean, if they were smart, they would deal with that in future scripts.
Well, I will tell you that on Sleepy Hollow, they do have a storyline coming up that deals with the legacy of slavery. You know, Sleepy Hollow is this show it's a supernatural set show. It's about Ichabod Crane suddenly waking up 250 years later in the modern times, but struggling with this supernatural conspiracy left over from the 1700s. And his partner in investigating this is a black female cop played by Nicole Beharie, who was in the movie 42. She played Jackie Robinson's wife. And so, again, you have this co-lead situation where, you know, you have a black female who's a cop. She gets to do a lot of things that you don't normally see black female characters get to do on television, you know, fighting the bad guys, shooting guns, being very physical. And they also have these storylines that can sort of harken back to the legacy of slavery, or there was a storyline where she saved her sister from a sanitarium. And we got to see two black women together on a show, both being very active, being very, you know, very much the heroes of the story. And so in subtle ways, they're presenting these characters that kind of defy stereotypes simply by casting people that you wouldn't necessarily expect in these roles. And I think it's a great development.
It is a great development.
I'm just waiting for the new Fox show where a person of color is the star.
There you go. Eric Deggans is NPR's TV critic. Thanks so much for joining us today. I hope you'll do it again in the future. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with our final segment. It's about the expression, huh?
Turns out he's dead, and that's why I'm singing.
What is wrong with the world today?
What's wrong with the world today?
Today's show was produced by Martin Scorsese and George Lucas. Correction, by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Jennifer Lawrence and Albert Gordon and Garrett Connolly. Bill Curry does not appear on this show. I'm sorry, my apologies. He was played by Hugh Grant. As always, go to WNPR.org for photos, news, and web-only features. On tomorrow's show, our salute to pigeons. And now, back to Colin.
All right, this is my favorite story of the weekend. It's a story about the exclamation, the sound, huh? And joining us to tell us a little bit more about this study connected to, huh, is Nick Enfield, a professor of linguistic anthropology at the Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics. That's in the Netherlands. He's joining us now. So let's start at the end and then go back to the beginning, Nick Enfield. One of the things that you found was that the sound seemed pretty much universal through languages as a way of sort of saying what, you know, what did you just say? And that's very unusual, right? If we tried to pick a sound even that was kind of onomatopoeia, a sound like what does a dog make? What sound does a dog make? And look at how that plays out in 35 languages. There would be different ideas even about what sound a dog makes. So how unique is it that everybody says, huh?
Well, we think that it's pretty unique. I mean, exactly as you say, those onomatopoeic words vary quite a lot. And in fact, if you sampled, you know, those dog barking words And I sort of, you know, said them back to you. You might not even recognize that what they were all about. So, you know, even the supposedly imitative words of language vary quite a lot across languages. And so this was a fairly surprising finding for us. And we were, of course, you know, hugely interested when we started to catch on to it and see that, you know, every time we checked a new language, it seemed to be the same kind of sound. And when we got deeper into it, I guess we... What we really saw was that the basis of this sound is not really imitation as such, but some other kinds of principles at work.
How did you catch on to this? How did you do the field work for this?
Well, we're working together here at our institute in quite a large group of field workers, linguists and anthropologists and some psychologists. And together we have a lot of different projects here where we compare various things about the languages that we work on. And in my own project, I have a grant from the European Research Council here to work on language and social interaction, and we were interested in a range of aspects of how people use language. And, one of these things was what we call repair. That's what you do when you have some kind of a problem understanding what the other was saying. So we got together with our group and we were looking at examples from our respective languages, you know, from these various different countries. And we noticed this. So together with my two colleagues who are co-authors on the paper, Mark Dingemanzer and Francisco Torreira, we decided to dig in a little bit more deeply. So with the help of our colleagues who supplied some of the data for us, we did the analysis that we report on in that in the paper that we've just published.
Now, one theory that you've advanced for this is the notion of convergent evolution, which I'll probably misstate right now, but kind of the nature that it's an urgent need that this thing that you call repair. If you're at the beginning of creating a language, the ability to express in a universally recognizable way that you don't understand what has just been said and that some kind of correction or more explanation is needed is an incredibly basic need in the evolution of language.
That's right. We think it's one of the, you know, it's just one of the fundamental things about human language that we're, you know, we have a kind of cooperative system where we're able to get people to stop and back up and clarify what they've said. How that actually played a role in the very earliest times of the evolution of language is an interesting question because, of course, you know, if language was simpler at some point in the past, then, you know, to get someone to repeat what they said, it would be interesting to see how they would elaborate. And we think that this is one of the reasons why animal communication systems have nothing like harm, because animal-type systems don't allow you to rephrase or be more specific, as it were. To, you know, I suppose if an animal system had something like that, all you could do was repeat exactly what was said before.
So this is we don't have time to go into this, but I mean, certain things might be almost at the level, as you just kind of suggested, of motor reflexes. But this isn't that, right? This is something that universally got developed.
That's true. So if you look at the kind of cries, the emotional cries and so on, you can see those things in all sorts of other animals. But this isn't that, because this is specifically structured within the language system, and it presupposes that you have a language with a system of mutual understanding before you can actually use this word. So it's not really, we don't think it's closely related to those kinds of cries, although perhaps distantly it might be related to things like expressions of surprise, as some have suggested.
All right. This is fascinating, and we want to talk more about this in the future. Nick Enfield, I hope you won't be a stranger. We love the Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics in the Netherlands. Thanks to everybody who helped out with today's show, especially Betsy Kaplan and Kion Wolf, the producers who take on the goal of getting this, take on the job of getting the show on the air on short notice. It was really fun, though. I hope you liked it. Whether you liked it or not, we hope to hear from you at Colin, C-O-L-I-N at WNPR.org. We'll be back tomorrow with our salute to pigeons.
She wanna dance with you. Well, there's a little girl dressed in blue. She wants you to show her just how to do. I'm talking about the Come on, baby, let me show you.
I'm Ophelia Quistar. Correction. I'm Scott Simon. Correction. I'm Michelle Norris. Correction. I'm Wade Goodwin. Correction. I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. Bonjour.